Hello and welcome to the English edition of Nachgehackt. My name is Henrike Tönnes and I'm here to talk to cybersecurity experts. And I'll make sure everyone understands. All systems ready? Then let's get started. Nobody likes to hear it, but it is the truth. Our personal data is only as safe as we are knowledgeable about keeping it safe. And let's face it, quite a few of us simply are not. Our privacy will not keep itself. So if we don't know what we're doing when we are interacting with systems in the cyber world, we have a problem. But fear not, my guest today has made it her objective to empower us clueless end users. In her research, she aims to find out how she can help us have more literacy and agency over our personal data. Yixin Zhou is a faculty member at the Max Planck Institute for IT Security and Privacy in Bochum, where she leads the Human-Centered Security and Privacy Group. And she will tell us everything we need to know about human computer interaction. Welcome, Yixin.
Thank you.
To Nachgehackt.
Hi.
So nice to have you.
I feel the sacred mission on my shoulder to protect end users.
Yes. No pressure, though, of course. Before we start and get into the thick of things, we always have three questions that we ask all our guests. So are you ready?
I'm excited.
Well, so the first one is maybe a little trivial. So what do you use your computer for most often?
It's very boring, as most people. I would say a lot of use relates to work, responding to a lot of emails, providing feedback on papers, projects, and so forth. And privately, I think mostly for online shopping.
Okay.
Watching some Netflix. Nothing exciting. Okay. A little bit gaming, maybe.
All right. Yes. What did you last shop?
Oh, yesterday I bought a very great steamer from
a
Amazon.
Steamer. Yes. All right. Sounds good. What do you think of first when you hear the term IT security?
Oh, I mean, I would say before I got into this whole like new research world about cybersecurity, maybe as a teenager, I think about the padlock, for example, when I go on a website and that's just there in a box, you know, or password. And that to me really rings the bell about IT security. Nowadays, as I'm naturally gravitating toward humans for my research, and maybe I think about, say, how people, like lay people, actually think about IT security. And maybe I will say it's even a little bit scary to me before I start doing the research. But then the more I do, I think the more I get a little bit more clue, even though I don't have a technical background myself.
Okay, I see. And last one, have you ever been hacked?
I would say extreme sense of hacking, in the sense that my account is taken over or my credit card is stolen, not so much. But I was very close to be hacked the other days. When I try making a reservation on a travel platform, it's very smart, very, very fishy thing when I thought it's from the host of the place I booked. But and the message said, you must confirm the reservation, otherwise you lose it. And I just followed through the link seamlessly. You know, I was working. I was I just want to get this done because I was waiting for this location for a long time. And then I clicked and then there are more and more messages coming in. And that's the part where I felt, well, this is very fishy. I need to report it to the platform.
Okay.
And I report it and then they say they will take care of it. And I also say change the password for some of my work, email, bank, just to be safe. And I think I get a handle of that, but it was very close. And I was very nervous at that moment.
I can imagine that. Yes. Sounds a bit scary. And
yes.
That in combination with vacation, how mean.
Yes.
Yes. when you're talking about all of these things, the security aspect and also the privacy aspect, that's something where you said, I'm, mm-hmm. I got used to this. I learned more and more about it. How are the two related, privacy and security?
Ah, okay. I do not want to bore the audience with academic definitions, but if I have to, my understanding is, say, security is more about the protection of information, sensitive information, and all the technical safeguards. Privacy, on the other hand, maybe is more about the individual's feeling that they want to be left alone and without the interference or being watched and have some agency over their personal data. But I will say, and this is a big lesson I learned from my own research, is when we communicate security and privacy with end users, they don't really care. And I don't think we need to spend a lot of time trying to draw the line for end users, because really a lot of user studies will tell us they just view them together collectively under the umbrella of safety. So I think maybe we just need to tell end users more about these are the concrete things you can do to stay safe online without digging into the relationship between the two.
So you say you found they don't care. Is it they don't care, or is it more that they are rather left alone with all of these things and they don't know how to navigate it and just give up?
I think both.
Both. Okay.
But to me, it's like it's important to understand end users' language and mirror it. So if I ask them, what do you think of security? And they give me some definition that actually maps to privacy, then I get, well, maybe the differentiation is not that important, or as we communicate to them, we just pick the language they are more familiar with. But when it comes to academic world, say when we write research papers, then it's different. There we do need to think about the concept we're tackling.
Okay. So would you say this is a topic where you actually have, in order for end users to gain more agency and superiority over this, you actually have to first take them by the hand and take their agency away a little bit and show them what to do, or what would you say?
It's tricky. I would say end users definitely need guidance.
Parenting, so to say.
Parenting depends on the type of parenting. Also, individual preference. There may be some people want more handheld guidance. They want to be bombarded with like 100 different things to do to stay safe online. Others will like just tell me the top three. So they need some guidance, but at the same time, giving them the agency is very important. So not to prescribe the solutions or assuming this is what they want and let the system configure everything, but they should have some settings and controls that they can play around with. Because maybe some people really don't care about, say, privacy, and they want to be very out there online. And I think as long as they understand the risks and consequence, and users should be able to just choose the way they want to present themselves online and interact with others.
Yeah. Does that also have to do with the user friendliness of devices that we deal with today? Is that maybe, you know, a point where you can say, hey, there is something that we can definitely do?
There are many, many things we can do about making things user friendly. I mean, little examples I can give, say, when we write emails, I really like this feature called undo send, because I write it and I'm like, oops, what is going on? I must like correct it, right? So undo send is a small thing, but it really reflects the user-friendly principle, which is we want to give users the ability to reverse the error. And another thing I can think of is, say, when we go to a website and we want to find the privacy policy, I think the habit for most people is to scroll toward the end of the website, the bottom of the website, not at the top. And so I think that reflects another principle, which is to be user-friendly, then we must make the path more learnable. Like users should be able to learn this is a fixed habit for them to find a certain setting or control. So a lot of little things we can configure, not just to the device, I will say to the interfaces, to the apps, to the features, lots of things we can do.
I also read that gamification of these things can be a very useful feature. Would you agree to that?
Yes, yes. I mean, I will caution that I'm not an expert on gamification. So for that, I will say, oh, like check other awesome research, what they are doing. But I'm very personally excited about, say, gamification's application in security training, in phishing training, for example, because I think the existing mode is, well, maybe employees are mandated to do it and click through a lot of modules, or they get phishing, well, fake phishing emails sent by their employers. And if they follow through, they get, you know, this very boring training materials they must complete within mm-hmm. the time. But gamification, I think, adds more fun to the learnability of security mm-hmm. so that it becomes a more enjoyable process. That's really helpful. That takes also the scary part away from security.
You didn't need gamification to be intrigued by this topic. So
now I have to do my job. So I think this is a good direction to go for human-centered cybersecurity research as well.
Yeah. How did you get interested in exactly that what you're researching right now? How did you land where you landed?
You mean the whole the topic itself, security and privacy.
Yeah.
Let me think. I mean, the honest answer will be I started my PhD and my PhD advisor was doing it.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
So I followed the path. But I mean, even before I chose my PhD, I think back to my undergrad time, I picked up a very interesting research project about, say, how individuals react after data breaches and cyberbullying. And I think that's where I start to think about privacy, say from a very noteworthy news cases like the Ashley Madison data breach. That's like a data breach that compromised a lot of sensitive data from an adultery website. So I studied that for the research project, and it makes
There's
me...
There's also a Netflix series on
yes,
that, right?
Yes,
I
yes,
saw
yes.
that just now.
That I watched it. I highly recommend it.
Ashley yes. Madison. Yeah, yes. that's an interesting case.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. And it really helped me draw the connection of, well, this is another news event, but actually it's privacy related, and then it really has ramifications on a lot of the victims and how their surrounding circles perceive them. And it's related to research and enjoying doing it and finding out the reality and the uncertainty in the process. So I think that's prompted me to do a PhD.
Yeah, very, very interesting. That's a great, great motivation to see where this real life moment comes in,
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, another thing I can also say is that I'm not academically trained as computer scientist. So mm-hmm. I actually got my PhD in information and I study advertising for my undergrad.
Oh, wow.
So there are a lot of pivots that people normally cannot tell my background based on my current position. But I really learned from doing human-centered cybersecurity research is one doesn't need a computer science formal training to do it, as long as you have an interest in talking to people and understanding the world and pick up some empirical methods that allow you to more maybe rigorously or scientifically talk to people and understand their wants and needs. That works. So I think all my previous experience actually equipped me to do my current job.
Yeah. And where the paths lead. It's always very interesting,
yes,
I think.
Yes.
So what are you currently focusing on mostly?
Yes. So within my group, I think we have a very big focus on uplifting the voices from underserved populations. Mm-hmm. So we have studies, say, interact with older adults and people who are deaf and hard of hearing, or people in the majority world. What I mean is, say, people who live, say, outside Western Europe or mm-hmm. United States or most of the very developed Western societies. And so we go into the field and interview or survey people living in these societies and understand their wants and needs.
Okay. And is there anything specific that you've already, where you say, wow, this is a point, this is very interesting, especially maybe with the elder mm-hmm. population, let's say?
Yes. For the elder population, I learned a lot from them as I do my research, in the sense that I think when we talk about elder people, in the media, etc., we always see the stereotype that they are left behind and they don't know how to use technology. I will say this is not the case. I observe when I do my study is say elder people is actually a very diverse population. Mm-hmm. So within some are actually very interested in learning about technology, very motivated to protect their security and privacy. Some will even go out of their way to educate their community members. So I think that really makes me realize not just the diversity of this group, but also we need to like highlight the diversity as we do security privacy outreach and talking to the general public is not to keep emphasizing the deficit of elderly, but really their strengths and they can be empowered to protect their information.
Yeah. And how do these differences manifest in other marginalized groups? Is that different?
I think there are some common patterns across different populations in the sense that if they're undeserved, it certainly means like the existing tools and resources we provide don't meet their needs. But I think the difference often comes from their particular wants and needs. So say for the deaf and hard of hearing project we're doing, there we find one of the biggest problems is say a lot of the security and privacy advice we currently provide is not coming with sign language. And a lot of deaf and hard of hearing people, they use sign language, maybe even as their native language. Mm-hmm. So if the thing is not provided in the way that they are familiar with, then they naturally cannot get the information as freely as hearing people do. And then they rely on their social circles, but their social circles may not know much about security and privacy either. That's tricky.
So how would you say can this be changed?
That's definitely say the concrete thing we can do is say make more things available in sign language. At the same time, I think it's also more awareness. That's very important. It's for professionals, researchers to know that this population is underserved. And then we need to think about providing everything in sign language. Or if we talk about other populations, just the things that can serve them and don't ignore their voice. Say, for people living in majority world, right? Researchers, we can very easily just go to people around us and talk to them, but then there are all the geographic and language barriers. Say, if I want to do research with people in India or Kenya or Ghana, these are some areas our group is covering now. We need to overcome the barriers, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. We should go out of our way to include them.
Yeah. And what was your most interesting bit or interesting scenario where you researched and where you said, wow, I didn't know that. That wasn't in your awareness maybe also.
I mean, there are so many moments I can think of this. I mean, there's maybe one that's like years ago. I think in 2018, when I first started doing cybersecurity research, I didn't know about the existence of Password Manager. So I think that's back then I still used the same password for some important accounts. I picked the one that's more memorable.
Yeah.
And I think it's only after I start doing research on password, I'm like, this is a really bad practice. And there are all the tools available that can help me memorize my passwords, autofill passwords for me. And I should really give it a try. And now I'm a big fan and I can recommend it to others as well.
Okay. So you're advocating this across all of the groups, about all of the people that you're researching on and working with?
I think if people ask me, say, what's your top security advice? I know a lot of people struggle with passwords, so I will say give password managers a try. But at the same time, I will also say it's really up to individuals. Like some people, they just have a natural fear of the cloud. And I see this very often in older population in particular. So for that, I think when I ran some workshops with older adults before, I just say, if you're comfortable with pen and pencil, write down your passwords on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Make sure it's locked in a safe place. But if you really don't want to bother with the digital means, don't pick the one that works for you.
Yeah, okay. I can imagine that challenges also always... You know, that there are always new challenges and that they always There are always new problems and difficulties that you have to navigate. So what would you say, what new challenges in terms of security and privacy do arise from, say, immersive technologies that we have now, like the metaverse or VR, AR, all of these things? Is there something that you need to pay attention to particularly?
Those are big buzzwords that create a lot of challenges mm-hmm. for our current research. So I will maybe highlight two mm-hmm. challenges I see. One is about privacy, in the sense that a lot of, say, the VR headsets, they collect a lot of information, mm-hmm. like not just the classic personal information that we put in when we register an account, but say to use a headset, it collects your movement, it does eye tracking, it has all the haptic collection of data. And it's a lot, but then if we simply apply the notice and controls we have in other environments, like on the website, it doesn't necessarily carry on. So say passwords, like you can imagine typing passwords on the keyboard very easily, but not so much when you have to like hold the laser pointer and enter your password when you wear a VR headset, right?
Yeah.
So the privacy challenge is really hard in that we need to be more creative in providing the settings and controls for users. The second one I can think of is digital safety challenges, in the sense that we see, say, cyberbullying or harassment in online environment in general, right? But then in VR, I think it's more amplified. So imagine harassment down, but now in a more inversive way, then it's definitely more harmful and triggering to the user who's experiencing it.
Mm.
And then what could make it worse is, say, a lot of teenagers are now on VR, especially social VR, and then there are very intimate activities, like people drink in VR, people share very intimate details. So for the users, especially for the younger population, I think it's very important to teach them about the risks in addition to the benefits when going into metaverse, and how can we also find a balance maybe between teens and parents, in that we maybe want to let parents know, but also parents shouldn't be too controlling in letting teens do their thing on VR, right? So the balance point we need.
It's a fine line to walk, isn't it?
Yes.
So how do you manage this? I mean, do you have a recipe for finding this balance somehow?
I'm not a parent myself, so I couldn't be very
just
useful.
Just asking.
Yes. And I think from the literature, I can see the big trend in team research now is, say, let's try to use a more resilience approach, like teach teams how to identify risks and be resilient against it, rather than being very paternalistic and tell them you can't do this, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. So what is your next step in your research now? What are you working towards? Or can you tell me?
I can. I'm just thinking, you know, there are so many moving pieces, which one to share. I think I'm definitely still very passionate about expanding the line of including marginalized underserved populations.
Mm.
I have also other ongoing projects with my team about understanding AI-based security and privacy risk. And I mean, these are also buzzwords, right? But we also see, say, within the European Union, there are emerging laws like the EU AI Act. And how do we understand the law? How do we implement it? Mm-hmm. How does the public perceive what's prescribed in the laws?
Mm-hmm.
So those are things that excite me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty much it.
This is very interesting, though, with this AI thing, just from my personal point of view, because I also work as a voice talent. And of course, AI and the voice and the laws behind that are also very interesting.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
It's a very comprehensive field, I think, very big field.
Yes.
Do you have a specific, you know, part of it that you like to focus on with this AI situation?
Yeah, I think two directions I can think of. One is, how do we help the general public understand the risks of AI?
Yes.
Because if we go to, again, narratives from the media about AI, I think still nowadays it's focused more on the benefits and how AI can create these societal goods.
How but cool it is.
Right, yeah. Right. I mean, it is very cool. I use ChatGPT myself. I mean, it helps with my research, not gonna lie. Like, sometimes it just gives me very useful information. But at the same time, all the biases, all the, you know, especially when AI is deployed in high-stake environments, then I think we need to do some education on lay people to understand the risk in order to make a more informed decision. The second direction is that maybe look into the interplay between, say, human-centered research and policy making, in the sense that how do general public understand the EU AI Act, and how can we maybe try to do some match between what lay people think and want with what the policymakers want to do about regulating AI, and try to find a balance point between the two.
Mm. Do you have a favorite scenario of teaching that to the general public? Is there something like that, your dream scenario? So how can you make everybody know about these things?
I mean, we're still at the early phase of experimenting. I think one approach we try so far in our latest project is say, if we want to teach them about biases, we might as well highlight, say, the historical injustice that comes from the training data, because a lot of the bias decisions AI makes are based on training data. And so that's our first step. It's just the plain text telling them about historical injustice. But I think some ideas I want to experiment in the future with my team is, say, how do we do it in a more interactive way? Mm-hmm. For example, a gamification approach. Can we apply that to AI education? Can we say there are ChatGPT, there are all the other chatbots. Can we bring chatbots in to, say, have a sandbox and let users play with the sandbox and experience the outcomes built out by the AI models, and then see if they can identify some risks and harms in this way. So the goal is the same, but I think there are different ways of reaching the goals that we can play with.
Yes. When you say sandbox, just to explain the term really quickly, it's not an actual like a sandbox thing, but what is it? Can you just quickly say?
Yes, I think at the virtual environment, it can be, say, it's a mocked app. You go in, maybe you have a persona created for you, say, I don't know, my name is Alice, I'm 35, these are all my data, this is a setting I can play with. If I toggle this setting, what will happen? So sandbox provides a simulated environment for
that. A safe space,
yes,
where you can actually make some mistakes if you have to and learn from them.
Exactly.
Without actually being harmed.
Yes, yes. Play with the sand online. Yes.
Yeah. That's very nice. So let's stay with this AI thing a little more. I think it has a lot of very interesting facets. Now, I think the development is rapid. I mean, that's even an understatement. So it goes into all directions. How does that impact your research field? I mean, there are so many, you know, innovations. Like, it feels like every minute there's a new system, a new add-on, new something. Yes. How does that impact your research?
It impacts a lot. And we really feel also the stress and the obligation to keep up with all the innovations. The approach my teams and I try to take, I think it's more like stay closer to the fundamental things that might remain the same amid all the changes. So say the modality of the training data can change, the application scenario can change, but maybe when it comes to the fundamental risks of AI, biases will continue, data leakage, data poisoning will continue. And so if the risk stays the same, maybe then if our goal is to teach the general public about the risk and empower them to mitigate these risks, it can also carry on, like even when the models keep evolving. But then say if our goal is different, is to say how to make the models or the AI apps more user-friendly, then I think there we do need to like keep up with everything that's happening, because a single little tweak can change user reactions.
Yeah, I think that might be very challenging as well.
Yes.
So, but amidst all this, you say that the basic fundamental challenges when it comes to security remain the same.
It remains the same to some degree. I think they are also, say, novel scenarios that where AI may amplify or even introduce new security and privacy risks. But then I think the job is for researchers to identify then what risks stay the same and what are the novel risks to tackle.
Yeah. And then make it understandable for the general public to navigate that very carefully.
Yes,
oh exactly. Oh my God, I don't want to be in your shoes there.
Yes, sacred mission we are trying to carry. Yes.
And when we take one of the buzzwords out and say the metaverse itself, what kind of a challenge will that provide for you?
Metaverse is, I think if we talk about the buzzword, I'm not even sure if it's still there now I think about it, because I think people talk about, oh, we're entering the metaverse, say 10 or 20 years ago. Like the Second Life is a very old, well, quote unquote old game, right? But it still exists. So I think for, say, the developers of and manufacturers of VR headsets, they have fundamental challenge to tackle for sure, say, the nausea and making the headset more lightweight, how to bring down the cost. All of these can maybe help us more quickly enter the actual metaverse we talked a lot about. At the same time, I think for my research, I do see that the use scenarios of VR keeps evolving. And that's something that we need to take into account when talking about security and privacy. Say, I think maybe 5-10 years ago, we still talk about gaming. But in our latest research, we found people actually use it for like the workplace. They have a VR desktop, or they use VR for, say, the intimate social activities. and these are, I think, novel applications that will bring in novel security and privacy risks as well.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Now, you've already given us your favorite cybersecurity, you know, takeaway thing with the password manager. Now, I have to say, we always ask our experts for, you know, for a takeaway and for a good tip when it comes to that. Now, I have to admit that many of your colleagues already hinted at this very specific cybersecurity gear thing of the password manager, like do this. Do you have something like a tip for the audience, you know, if you want to be secure online, what they should do? Apart from this.
Apart from password manager.
I know, it's a little mean.
No worries.
So we get two tips from her. This is a freeloading deluxe situation.
So that password manager is a practical one, but I think I can offer another piece of advice, which is a mentality change. Just view cybersecurity as something fun, something learnable, something not scary. Because I guess I share my personal experience as someone who knows absolutely nothing about the field. 6 years ago, still was using the same password across different accounts 6 years ago. And I think now I'm at least a little bit more articulated than myself back then about knowing the risk as someone who hasn't done any formal computer science training. So I think it's really something that can be tackled, even not like in an academic setting, but I think like read online, search for tips like how to stay safe online. There's a very good Google article, I think a few years ago. It won a Lasting Impact Award just this year. That's like top three pieces of advice, staying safe online. I would highly recommend it. I know the mentalities, there are little things one can do to protect their security and privacy without a technical background.
Yes, and also without having to study, although, of course, it's always very good.
It can be a bit boring,
Yijin, thank you very, very much for being here. That was a very, very interesting talk. And, for you, I will see you again. There will be another English episode very soon. So thank you for being here with us. And we'll just say goodbye from Nachgeckt. See you next time.
Bye.
That was the English edition of Nachgehackt. I hope you learned as much about cybersecurity as I did today. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you like our podcast, feel free to leave us some stars. Until next time, and stay secure. Nachgehackt is produced by Cube 5 and the Cluster of Excellence CASA at the Horst Goertz Institute for IT Security. Many thanks for the support to FISAC, Bochum Economic Development, and Eurobits.